You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the July-August 2022 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair, Part A. Here's the continuation of Scene Stealer by Evgenia Peretz. In 2012, Finch landed a writing job on the Vampire Diaries, earning the joke nickname Vampire Girl. According to a writer on the show, she was meek in the room, barely said a word. This was a rough atmosphere, with writers routinely fearing they'd end up on the chopping block. Shortly thereafter is when Finch herself got cancer, or so she claimed. Not breast or ovarian cancer, but this rare and more fatal bone cancer, which was discovered after alleged knee replacement surgery. The tumor in her spine had grown so big that surgery risked paralysis, she wrote, so it required chemotherapy right away. Her closest relative at the time was an older cousin in New Jersey who considered Finch a younger sister. It was devastating, the cousin recalls, learning the diagnosis. As chemotherapy got underway, Finch would occasionally visit from Los Angeles. She was bald. There was a bandage over the place where a chemo port would go, and she looked sick. The cousin's daughter, then 14, idolized Finch, her cool relative with a Hollywood job who made her awesome mixtapes. She recalls the night they went up to her bedroom and Finch told her that there was a good possibility of her dying and how special she was to her. We lay on the bed and cried together, she says. Finch's mother, Joan, was desperate to come to Los Angeles to help care for her. But Finch kept her parents away, which crushed them, according to a source close to the family. When people wondered why she rejected their care, she explained that they were overbearing and impossible to be around. Over the years, her brother, Eric, a doctor in Florida, talked about wanting to speak with her doctors about her treatment, says the source, but she wouldn't let him. In spite of her illness, Finch valiantly flew in for big events back east. Her mother's 60th birthday, graduations. But she'd only stay for a few hours before having to fly off to somewhere important. We'd take any time we could get with her, says her cousin. It was like, oh my God, she's so fabulous. People close to her chalked it up to Finch's independence. Finch, as recounted in that first article for Elle, a connection she made through her close friend Mickey Rapkin, then a writer there, was instilled to treat adversity with quiet dignity. Finch had told friends that there were two shows she was dying to work for, Grey's Anatomy and Parenthood. Lo and behold, when she landed the job at Grey's Anatomy, a dream come true. There was an obstacle along the way. According to sources at the show, a few seasons into Finch's stint, writer Krista Vernoff took over as showrunner and did a blind read of writers' work to see who's matched her own vision. Finch didn't make the cut, and she was let go when the show got restaffed. But Finch was rescued when someone at Shondaland resurfaced the old Elle article for Vernoff and asked her to reconsider. The woman literally lives for her work. She was promptly rehired. Like most writers' rooms, the Grey's Anatomy room, which consisted of roughly 17 people, was an intimate, sacred space for people to share all kinds of stories and confessions. For 10 hours a day, the group would churn over past humiliations, scandals that had consumed friends, dark family secrets. They'd mix and match, map them onto the arcs of the show's many characters. Gray's was diverse before its time and suffused with a kind of empathy that made Finch, the only person in the writer's room who identified as a person with a disability, as she wrote in The Hollywood Reporter, a perfect fit. Unlike at The Vampire Diaries, here she had a presence. She excelled in the area of personal confession, laying her pain bare, often with an appealing, familiar humor. Other times, she'd laugh at something tragic, laughed so hard until she cried. People figured it was a coping mechanism. She carried her heart and her cancer on her sleeve. She was visibly sick and getting sicker. In addition to the baldness and scarves, she wore a bandage over a presumed port on her upper chest. You could see it behind her baggy tank top and cardigan. Her skin had a yellow-greenish hue, which she covered with badly blended cover-up. She could sometimes be heard retching in the bathroom, at which point the producers would insist, "Please go home." "No, no," came the valiant reply. "I really want to be here. Just let me do an hour more." Cancer afforded her certain privileges. She had an extra comfortable chair. From there, she tacitly claimed extra talking rights. The writer's room was like one Jewish nosh table on a Sunday morning, as one writer describes it, with everyone talking over each other. But when Finch had the floor, she was not to be interrupted and took whatever time she needed drawing out her stories. Anyone else could lose their job for being such a room hog. We all tolerated it because we thought she might be dying. These might be her final words, says this writer. Co-workers recall that her frequent bouts of illness and mental stress coincided with deadlines for her episodes. In these instances, she'd often have to pull in a senior writer to pick up the slack. She showed little interest in returning the favor for other people's episodes. Lest anyone forget that cancer was an ongoing battle, she took frequent weeks-long leaves to do what she claimed were clinical trials. She corralled a group of loving friends to help her. She had rented a condo near the Mayo Clinic from her good friend Nick, whose family, sources say, treated her like a surrogate daughter. Nick would drive her to appointments. She'd get out of the car, enter the building, and then he'd drive off. She might snap a picture of the Mayo Clinic exterior for Instagram with a tag like, "There are giants in the sky." Another friend helped organize care packages. She and a third friend, Molly, became the point people who updated friends and family with information. One day, when Nick was traveling for work and unable to take her to the clinic, Finch asked her cousin in New Jersey to step in. "I couldn't go," recalls the cousin. "I was devastated that I couldn't be there for her." But Finch didn't want anyone to get too close. When friends asked if she wanted company during her treatments, she declined. She didn't want anyone she loved to be connected to her cancer memory, she explained. The friends she collected were empaths. Many had been touched by cancer themselves. The disease created other health complications. In 2017, she needed a kidney transplant. She posted on Facebook, "Two hospital hangouts, nearly 2 weeks of hell, but finally, one happy, healthy kidney. Thanks for all the," and here she puts a heart emoji. According to a staffer, Finch said that Anna Paquin was to thank. Paquin and Finch had become friends, for real, on True Blood. Paquin did not comment to Vanity Fair. Normal life couldn't roll on for too long before Finch's illness reared its head. There were sudden bouts of dangerous overheating or weakness in inopportune moments, like at her relative's college graduation ceremony, or on a trip to Jerusalem, also with this family member, when they were swarmed with cyclists in the middle of a bike race. People would flock to her side to attend to her. On the trip back from Israel, she threw a fit when she was made to check her bags because she said her cancer meds were inside. She tweeted later, "At Delta, you cannot insist a cancer patient check meds. Lose the bag and insist nothing can be done." At her 40th birthday in March 2018, a pajama party with roughly 100 guests held at an event space in downtown Los Angeles, cancer was the top of conversation. Over cake, Finch addressed the crowd, including Alan. "Everyone here in the room is someone I know and love, and over the last very bizarre 7 years has been instrumental in helping me get to 40, including, they wish not to be identified personally, but there are two doctors from Mayo Clinic who flew all the way from Minnesota. I promised that I would not show them, but I wanted them to be surrounded by people I love so fiercely, who love me so fiercely. It was one of the few occasions that people from her various pods in life interacted with one another." Finch first wrote chondrosarcoma into Grey's Anatomy in 2016, when a sassy, know-it-all teenage girl amputee announces to two male doctors, "Turns out I'm one in like a bajillion kids to get chondrosarcoma. We have our work cut out for us, gentlemen." Gradually, Finch's cancer metastasized, taking over the communal creative process in the room. When cancer stories were brought up as potential storylines, Finch seized the territory, say co-workers. There were two other survivors, but she was the one living with cancer now. Once, when a writer pushed back on an emotional direction Finch wanted to take a story, she lashed out, "This is how it feels, and none of you can understand," and stormed out. Eventually, one of the survivors didn't even bother chiming in on cancer-related stories. In 2018 came the Catherine Avery chondrosarcoma storyline. Finch claimed in one of her articles that she resisted sharing her personal story. "I wanted to say no, a big, fat, super emphatic, though ever polite, no." But the loving insistence from her co-workers broke down her walls. "I said yes because Shonda once wrote me an email where she told me, 'Love yourself more.' And when Shonda says something like that, you listen." According to someone in the room, the conversation actually went more like this. "Finch, it would be so amazing to give Catherine my cancer, but maybe I shouldn't write it. It might be too triggering." "Okay, we'll protect you. Someone else can do it." Finch, "No, I can do it." Indeed, Finch needed little arm-twisting to write about her cancer in 8 cancer-themed articles, including "I Confronted the Doctor Who Missed My Cancer," featuring the clueless Dr. Perfect, who cocks his head to the side and says, "You seem angry." There was also deciding to have an abortion while getting chemo, redefining Brave, and All My Eggs in One Basket about her cancer and fertility choices. The latter she wrote from a perch at Hedgebrook, the prestigious and highly competitive writer's retreat for women trying to bring out positive change in the world. She used her illness as the basis of her application. Next photo, Anatomy of a Scandal. Elizabeth Finch, with Grey's Anatomy colleagues, including Debbie Allen, whose character embodied some of Finch's issues, and actor and director Kevin McKidd. Likewise, cancer meant opportunities to pick fights online, with tweets now deleted like, "Talk to me when you've screamed yourself to sleep at night from the pain, and I'll argue about the merits of legalizing marijuana every damn where." And, "I've officially run out of ways to politely say this, stop tweeting me miracle cancer cures. It's exhausting and insulting and presumptuous AF." For Finch, as for many people, the Trump years were a time of greater outspokenness. Days after his victory in 2016, an unknown person allegedly left an ugly anti-Semitic tract outside her door. She posted the offensive picture along with, "Yes, I am the only Jewish person in my building, located in Santa Monica. Yes, I am the only one who received this on my doorstep. In March 2018, in the heat of hashtag Me Too, she wrote in The Hollywood Reporter about the alleged harassment she endured years prior by a director on the set of another show, which included misogynistic verbal abuse and unwanted touching. When Brett Kavanaugh was nominated to the Supreme Court, she repurposed her cancer abortion story for a PSA-style video, reminding people that her ability to have an abortion saved her life. By then, her hair had grown out, but she told viewers, "I may never be cancer-free." On the day Christine Blasey Ford testified, Finch couldn't not offer words on Facebook. Men, find a way today to tell the women in your life that you believe them. Don't assume they know. Not today. Hashtag Believe Survivors. Then, in late October 2018, a national tragedy hit when 11 people were shot and killed at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, the city where Finch went to college. The next day, she began telling people that an older friend she'd met while in college had been one of the victims. She mustered up her fury. "Please do not send me photos of the man who murdered my friend," she tweeted at a hapless account. Gray's writers had to be careful with their language. If someone mentioned guns in the room or complained that their pitch had been shot down, she dramatically winced, according to one colleague. Within a few months, the narrative had new details. She had helped clean up the remains of her friend's body from the synagogue floor. It was all in step with the Jewish tradition, she explained, which said Jews must be buried within 24 hours with all their body parts. Subsequent shootings brought the trauma right back up. In March 2019, shortly after the mosque shootings in New Zealand, she tweeted, "I spent sunup to sundown cleaning up what was left of my friend after the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting. And as someone who stood amidst the Pittsburgh synagogue carnage, I'll just say, my heart is broken. My brain is broken. I have no words for my outrage." Eventually, Catherine Avery's cancer plot would play itself out. Just like the amazing Finchie, the amazing Catherine would live with cancer while maintaining her rock star career. But another character became interesting to her, a troubled young surgeon named Joe Wilson, and she proposed a storyline. After meeting a patient who's a rape victim, Joe starts confronting her own past as an abused wife and learns that she's a product of rape, a pitch, Finch said, that was based on a friend. According to a staffer, writing that first episode was stress-inducing for Finch. She turned to the others in the room to help write it, although hers was the only name credited. Still, she claimed the rest of Joe's storyline for the season. Discussions were had in the room about Joe needing to check herself into a mental health facility to deal with her trauma. Now, Finch just needed the rest. Finch told her employer that she was suffering from PTSD related to Pittsburgh and needed 6 weeks off. She checked herself into a mental health clinic in Arizona. She was no longer wearing a bandage. The name she used was Joe. In January 2019, Jennifer Beyer arrived at an Arizona mental health treatment center, believing she'd never get to see her kids alone again. She was suffering severe PTSD from all she'd been through in her 18-year marriage. No one understood what she knew but couldn't articulate for so long that Brendan was an abuser and master gaslighter in the original sense of the word. In their small, liberal community in Topeka, most people saw him as a doting father with the right values. While she worked at the hospital, "The best nurse I ever worked with," says a former colleague, Brendan was a member of the grassroots advocacy group Indivisible and was often picketing with the kids in tow. But behind closed doors, he controlled Jennifer's every movement, she says, and was physically and sexually violent. At his insistence, she explained away her bruises and broken bones as the result of falls in the shower or down the stairs. When she led on to others the truth about his behavior, they couldn't believe it. His line was that she was mentally ill, suffering from postpartum depression, and she was making it all up. He told her that if she revealed the truth, she wouldn't make it. Fearing for her life, she took out a protection order against him and filed for divorce. This forced him out of the house, but he moved nearby and made sure she knew he was watching her. Next photo, survivor, Jennifer Beyer, Finch's estranged wife, discovered the truth, or truths. All of that led to the haunting incident that brought her to the Arizona Treatment Center. She began having dissociative episodes, breaks from one's reality and surroundings. On December 27th, 2018, a date that's etched into her brain, she was driving her car with two of her young sons strapped in the back. Then suddenly, without realizing it, she pulled the car over, opened the door, and walked some distance. A few minutes later, she came to, and panic jolted through her. "Where are my kids?" Hysterical, she immediately called the police, who were sympathetic. Within minutes, the kids were located, and she was reunited with them. The next day, she was called into the Office of Child Protective Service. Believing she was safe, she shared what had happened. But afterward, she was informed that CPS was charging her with child abandonment. She was psychotic, Brendan told people, and now there was evidence. With a divorce proceeding looming and everything on the line, she entered a mental health facility to prove she was sane and a fit mother. The woman sitting across from me in a Topeka coffee shop on a rainy March day is extremely fragile, soft-spoken. There's a service dog at her feet to help her with continued PTSD. As she gets going, though, she seems the antithesis of how Brendan tried to paint her to the outside world. She's warm, articulate, and emotionally intelligent, which is part of the reason she's scared to tell her story. She's scared of repercussions, scared of appearing so gullible to the world. But it's also why she knows she has to. She wants to make sure that the person who targeted her can never do that to somebody else, and that person wasn't Brendan. The Jennifer Beyer who entered treatment is a far cry from the Jennifer Beyer of today. Then she was unable to function, a walking live wire. She couldn't sit with anyone or make eye contact. The mere sound of a door scared her. A sudden noise would send a flash of panic through her body. In her small therapeutic process group, she was unable to talk about everything that had happened. Beyer was afraid of what this meant. Maybe she really was hopelessly crazy. The therapist, particularly one named Carly, started to grasp what had happened to her. According to Beyer, Carly could see this was PTSD with dissociative episodes, and she was determined to do whatever it took to bring Beyer back to health, even if it took months. Disturbing news from home didn't help. Brendan had been arrested and had torn up an emergency room. The kids were sent to a foster home, but after a few days, they would have to split up. They ended up with Brendan's mother. About 6 months into Beyer's stay, a new resident named Joe arrived and became part of Beyer's process group. Joe, the first name of a Grey's Anatomy character that Finch was researching, was also suffering from PTSD after the shooting at the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh, she said. Her friend was one of the victims, she explained. And in accordance with Jewish tradition, Joe had helped clean up the body from the synagogue floor. To Beyer, The signs of Joe's PTSD started to seem exactly like her own. Joe had to sit alone in a big group. Joe, too, was unable to make eye contact or sit by doors, couldn't deal with sudden noises, and struggled to talk about the details of her trauma. The similarity gave Beyer comfort. After all, if someone like Joe, who had told people she was a professional writer and who didn't seem insane, was having the same challenges, maybe Beyer wasn't crazy after all. The two women started talking. And talking. For the first time ever, therapist saw Beyer laugh, she recalls. Joe suggested they become roommates. It was not the norm for two people in the same process group to become roommates. But the staff could see how beneficial Joe's friendship was to Beyer's healing. As they grew closer, Beyer noticed that as the trauma from Pittsburgh receded, another one was coming into view for Joe, that her brother, Eric, had been cruel and violent to her as a child, something she had never grappled with until now. It was another similarity. Beyer had Brendan, Joe had Eric, and it brought them closer. Family weekend was approaching, and Joe's parents planned to come visit. Two of Finch's compartments were about to meet for the first time. It would take some tap dancing. First, Joe needed to explain the whole name thing. She revealed to Beyer she was an important writer on Grey's Anatomy and that she was using a pseudonym so that word didn't get out. Joe said she had given the same explanation to her parents before their arrival and asked that they address her as Joe, not Elizabeth. In the first meeting, when Joe went on about Eric's cruelty during childhood, Joan and Robert listened, bewildered, Beyer recalls. Sure, there were sibling fights, but they had not witnessed any of the suffering she was describing. Still, Joan was placating to Finch's perception of her childhood. The next day, Joan opened up about how much she had worried about her daughter over the years, about the cancer, how she would have wanted to be there for her. Cancer? It was the first time anyone in treatment, including Beyer, had heard about it. Finch replied that yes, she was living with cancer, but she didn't want to talk about it. Beyer respected that. Just like Beyer, Joe was living with enormous pain. Carly, as a matter of course, had been in possession of Beyer's phone and had been receiving all kinds of angry, obsessive texts from Brendan. If a message seemed pertinent, Carly would sit with Beyer and read it to her, something Joe seemed to find interesting, Beyer says. Now a video came in of Brendan saying, "I'm coming to get you." Beyer met with the head of security. The staff arranged to have increased security around the facility. And then, in another remarkable coincidence, Finch claimed that Eric was closing in on her. Her parents had left a family photo album upon their departure. As Finch told it, she was just flipping through it. And inside, she found a handwritten letter composed by him, threatening her. Beyer saw Finch holding this letter, but she didn't ask to hear the details. There was only so much fear of men Beyer could handle. Eric Finch and his parents did not respond to Vanity Fair. By early July 2019, both women were ready to leave the center and head back to their respective towns. The staff had been in the process of helping Beyer obtain a service dog to help her keep present when she was having episodes. The dog was expensive. Finch interceded and asked Carly if she could pay for it. Beyer was deeply moved by this parting gesture. It solidified a profound connection. The women had an emotional farewell. They made plans to keep in touch, to not let their friendship die. Finch returned to Hollywood and began filling in the contours of her newly recovered trauma. To a friend, she elaborated on the menacing letter found in the photo album, which had said, "Keep your mouth shut." She added a specific ugly detail about Eric's abuse, a detail that was identical to something Beyer had confided that Brendan did to her when they were married. Meanwhile, Beyer returned to Topeka, and oh, how she missed Joe, the name she continued using for her friend. She moved into a shelter, unable to see her kids except for 1 hour a week under supervision, and faced numerous in-person court dates with Brendan, the thought of which terrified her. Brendan continued taunting her. He now posted pictures on social media of random spots near the shelter, signaling that he knew where she was. Finch reeled in Beyer's love just when Beyer needed it. She invited Beyer to come stay at her house in California, a beautiful spread she'd seen pictures of in their room at the treatment center. It was just the escape Beyer needed. The house was in Ojai, the most heavenly place she'd ever seen. There was a big gate at the entrance, a gorgeous sprawling yard with orange trees and a swimming pool. Beyer wondered how she could afford it all. Finch told her that it was Anna Paquin's house. That much was true, but that she owned part of it. Finch does not own part of Paquin's house, a source confirms, nor does Paquin have anything to do with Finch's kidneys. There were a couple of black cars out on the street. Finch claimed it was security, a luxury she had at all times. The pair spent the weekend cooking, swimming, lounging, laughing, and falling in love. They took dozens of selfies of their love. Wouldn't it be great to make a slideshow and send it to Carly to show her how happy we are, suggested Finch, who talked a lot about Carly that week. And later, she did send it. The joy I felt that weekend was incredible, Beyer recalls. When Beyer returned to Kansas and the shelter, Finch love-bombed her with text and sentimental gifts, including a purple-stuffed kidney. As they talked about the future, Finch underlined the importance of honesty. Writing in a text that channeled Shakespeare, "My expectations are and always will be this. Don't lie to me. That's all I ask. It can annoy us or bum us out or even hurt us, but the truth will out, always." After Brendan, Beyer was scared of getting close to someone again. These were the exact words she needed to hear. Finch's love fortified Beyer as she faced her demons. In preparation for the first court date, Finch came out to Kansas for emotional support. She stayed in the Cyrus Hotel, Topeka's nicest, where the lovers' relationship flourished. On the day, Beyer entered the courthouse, accompanied by Finch and a couple of close friends. She was terrified to see Brendan, and there he was. He got in Beyer's face, repeating in an urgent monotone, "I need to talk to my wife. I need to talk to my wife." Finch physically got between them and told him to back off. "You need to go." Finch seemed so fearless, so in charge. Beyer's friends were completely bowled over. Beyer was so lucky to have this woman in her life, they thought. This tough, famous Hollywood writer who was willing to come all the way here to support the woman she loved. As a friend recalls, "After all she had been through with Brendan, we felt like Jen deserved something good." September 5th, 2019, another court date with Brendan was approaching, and Beyer needed the hit of support that only Finch could provide. Beyer flew to Los Angeles and was being driven to the Grey's Anatomy production office when she got a phone call from the Kansas Department of Children and Families, DCF, in Topeka. She was told to return to Kansas immediately. "Your husband has killed himself. Your kids are safe." Hysterical, she texted Finch with the news. When the car pulled up to the Grey's Anatomy building, Finch came running out, hugged her, and then quickly ushered her into her private office before she could interact with anyone. Once inside her office, Finch got Carly on the phone. Meanwhile, Finch bustled around the office. telling people an emergency had come up and she needed two tickets back to Kansas immediately. Finch returned to Kansas with Beyer and stayed while Beyer processed the news with her children. Finch was meeting them for the first time. Brendan had trashed every inch of the house that Beyer would soon be moving back into. 2 weeks after the suicide, still in Topeka, Finch, unbeknownst to Beyer, wrote the following email to the writing staff at Gray's Anatomy. "Hey all, I've been absent and coming back tomorrow. I just don't know who's looped into what, and I'd rather put it out there so no one is in the dark or feeling eggshelly. I've gone because my brother died by suicide. He was on life support for a short while, but ultimately did not survive. I say this not because I need or want anything from anyone. I'm not a delicate flower or whatever. I just want people to know I'm still here, still part of the team. I intended to just power through my episode shoot, but I recognized I needed to just take a bit of time away to process. Missed y'all. Finchy." She later elaborated to her Grey's Anatomy friends that because Eric was a doctor, he knew exactly how to shoot himself without killing himself, forcing her to be the one to pull the plug. It was his final act of vindictiveness, like trashing a house. We cried with her, one recalls. French was now fully committed to two divergent realities, one with her girlfriend and another with her Grey's Anatomy family. Keeping both realities intact required a bold sleight of hand. Shortly after Brendan's suicide, Finch took Beyer on a trip to Hawaii, where they stayed at the fanciest hotel she'd ever seen. Finch told Beyer it was a work trip. Meanwhile, she told work she was going to Hawaii because she had to reunite her dead brother's illegitimate Filipino baby with the baby's mother in Hawaii. Back in the Beyer reality, Finch's brother was very much alive, but dangerous. On one visit to Finch's apartment in Santa Monica, the women entered to find a pigsty strewn with empty alcohol bottles. Beyer was upset. She had made it clear to Finch that she hated alcohol, that the smell of it was triggering for her. Finch came up with a quick explanation. Eric must have broken in and trashed the place. At this point, Beyer panicked about their romantic involvement. Getting her kids back was her number one goal. After Brendan, she couldn't afford to be with a person who had someone so dangerous in her life. Sometime later, Finch assured her that everything was going to be okay. Eric had gone to the Philippines, and per a legal order, he could not return without her being notified. Beyer accepted this explanation and went on. After all, she needed Finchy, and Finchy loved her. Then, Finch, in a curious move, brought her worlds together. In November 2019, Finch was to receive a Sentinel Award, an award for television that educates viewers to make safer choices for their lives. For her first Joe episode, Silent All These Years, and she invited Beyer to come out. Beyer was reluctant. A red carpet Hollywood awards thing was beyond intimidating. But Finch said she wanted her to have a dazzling evening and to get all pretty. She bought Beyer heels and took her to the hairdresser. A friend let her borrow a dress. Going into the event, Finch led the way. Beyer noted how she breezed them in quickly. So quickly, they didn't talk to anyone and went straight to their seats. On their way home, they shared a car with Debbie Allen, who sat between them. Finch breathlessly controlled the conversation, asking Beyer to show Allen pictures of her children and their talents. The television star oohed and aahed over them, a surreal moment for Beyer. Later that month in Kansas, in preparation for the kids coming out of foster care, Beyer led the cleanup of the house Brendan had trashed. The act had become a ceremonial communal affair. A dumpster was delivered. Many people, including nurses from the hospital, helped fix doors and faucets and scrubbed every inch. Bench, in her yellow rubber gloves, took a starring role. A friend had brought a chainsaw, which Beyer used to cut up her bed, the site of marital rape. Finch took the video of it all, which they discussed sending to Carly. Like that day in court, Beyer's friends couldn't believe how generous Finch had been to fly in from Hollywood like that, especially after she told them that she was missing the Emmys that night, and she had been nominated for one. An Emmy? They all knew this was a huge deal. Although no one bothered to check the internet, the Emmys had already taken place 2 months earlier. Beyer's daughter, her oldest child, was so touched that she made up an Emmy victory dance for Finchie in front of the dumpster. As one Kansas friend who was there posted on Facebook, "The more I get to know Finchie, the more I realize she's actually a superhero masquerading as a regular person." On Thanksgiving, Finch proposed. They wanted to get married as soon as possible so that they could set the wheels in motion for legal adoption. "If something ever happened to Beyer," Finch said, "she wanted to make sure the kids would never end up back in foster care." After all Beyer had been through, the thought soothed her. Finch consulted Rhymes about her adoption lawyer. The kids started calling Finch Joe Mama. Soon after their engagement, Beyer had her first doubt about Finch's veracity. Beyer's oldest son had landed a role in The Nutcracker to be performed over Christmas at the Topeka Performing Arts Center. It was a momentous occasion for Beyer, who hadn't seen him dance in a year. She planned a party with family and friends to celebrate his accomplishment. During the party, Finch said she was having excruciating pain. "It's probably kidney stones," she said. Beyer said she should go to the hospital and that she'd go with her. Finch vehemently resisted the idea, but Beyer insisted. When they were face to face with the doctor at the hospital, Finch, to Beyer's exasperation, wasn't saying anything about her medical history. Beyer stepped in to say that Finch had cancer and only one working kidney. The doctor said, "Let's go into the donut of truth," referring to the donut-shaped CT machine. When the results came back, he looked at Beyer and asked pointedly, "Are you married?" Beyer said no, but that they planned to be soon. Looking squarely at Beyer, the doctor said her kidneys look fine, stressing the plural. After they were discharged, Finch dismissed his wording. "He probably just meant that my one working kidney looked fine," she said. Finch later groused, "They don't care about my pain." Beyer pushed the strange incident to the back of her head, and in February 2020, they got married on the beach in Palos Verdes. It was just them and two sparkly Hollywood names. Mickey Rapkin, who wrote the book on which Pitch Perfect was based, and Rapkin's husband, the actor Jason Butler Harner, who performed the ceremony. Soon, the women would start looking for a house in Los Angeles big enough for the whole family. Rhymes excitedly shared with Finch information about which Los Angeles schools would be a good fit. Those first months of marriage coincided with the arrival of COVID. Finch's cancer took center stage. Grey's Anatomy producers talked about getting her a hotel room in Topeka to protect her from being around the kids. Her colleagues were perpetually worried about Finch and COVID, according to one. Meanwhile, Beyer's kids took pains to protect her. Her daughter chose to stop attending school in person for her benefit. When one of Beyer's sons came down with COVID, the boy's main fear was for Finch, that he might cause her death. The summer and fall of 2020 brought more stress. The anniversary of her brother's suicide was so traumatic that Finch wouldn't be able to meet deadlines, she told coworkers. As the National Guard rolled into cities and George Floyd protests turned violent, Finch found fresh triggers for the Pittsburgh trauma. Firecrackers, loud sounds from movies, a rainy night, all could bring her crime scene back. A dream catcher with a tree of life design that Beyer had on the wall was too upsetting for Finch. She made Beyer take it down for a period. On one occasion, Beyer's daughter's school suddenly went on lockdown when a suspicious character was spotted on school grounds. While Beyer and other parents descended on the school, confused and panicked about their children's safety, Finch stayed home, citing her Pittsburgh trauma. One day, with a tinge of suspicion, Beyer began scrolling through Finch's Facebook. She scrolled all the way back to the day of the shooting, October 27, 2018, and found that Finch had been out with Rapkin. The next day, the day she was supposedly cleaning up her dead friend's body, she was again out with friends. A chill went through Beyer's body. She continued scrolling more frantically now. Here were pictures of Finch when she had a bald head, yet her eyebrows and eyelashes were still full. As a nurse, she knew that chemo patients who lose their hair often experience the loss of other body hair, like brows and lashes. She found pictures that showed the bandage over what was presumably a port scar. A port scar? Finch didn't have one. Beyer knew her body as intimately as a person could. The bandage itself looked shoddy, wrinkled, and open at the edge in places, which would allow for infections. She'd put such bandages on patients many times and knew the correct way to do it. This was not it. A hideous fear began sinking in. Beyer gathered herself as she prepared for a confrontation. She had a plan in mind. To love Finch harder in the weeks leading up, to let Finch know she could trust her, and to take baby steps. They were in the Topeka house, having just woken up. Beyer said, as gently as she could, "It would be good to know what medications you're on." Beyer had asked the question before, but Finch had found the query too triggering as it reminded her of her brother. But that morning, Finch listed them off. In response to one of the drugs, Beyer said she highly doubted she was taking it, even if she had a bottle of it. Beyer knew the drug to be extremely toxic, especially to one's kidney function, and that any doctor prescribing it would need to be supervising that patient regularly. Finch wasn't under such care. It was getting tense. With the kids getting up, Beyer suggested they take a drive and continue the conversation in the car. They parked by the mall. Beyer, holding back on all she knew, listened patiently as Finch made a confession. Well, a partial one. Finch admitted that she had at one time had cancer, but that she got chemo and recovered. She explained how she loved the attention so much that she continued to pretend she had it. Beyer upped the ante. So, if you had chemo once, then where's your port scar? There was nowhere for Finch to go with this one. Beyer said, I think there's more that you need to tell me. They were leaving the next day for Los Angeles to look at houses. Beyer demanded that while they were in California, Finch tell her everything. While looking for the perfect house to spend the rest of their lives in, Beyer privately agonized. Later, at Finch's Santa Monica apartment, she unloaded with what she knew as well as what she suspected. I know you were targeting me, mirroring me. I think you yourself wrote that threatening letter from Eric. I don't think the details about the shooting were real. Finch replied, Yes, yes. According to the coordinators of the two Shever Kadisha burial societies that conducted the cleanup in Pittsburgh, nobody named Elizabeth Finch was involved. As Beyer recalls, there was no emotion, no tears. Finch maintained that she was a victim of her brother's childhood cruelty, the one piece she held on to, as if this fact somehow explained the rest. Beyer told Finch she couldn't live like this. keeping all this to herself, and that she needed to confide in someone else. Upon their return to Kansas, they began telling a few key friends, the same support group who'd been there for court and the house cleanup. But the whole thing took a chilling turn. The friends accepted that Finch lied, but it all seemed to roll right off. In the scheme of things, they still considered her to be Byer's dazzling savior, a misapprehension that made Byer spiral further. Finchie, meanwhile, told them that Byer was falling apart because of her own past trauma, that Byer was conflating her, Finch, with Brendan, and they seemed to believe it. Byer was desperate for someone to talk to. Her longtime local therapist had just retired after an injury. She reached out to Carly, dearest, devoted Carly, who told her she'd provide some referrals. Then Finch dropped a bomb. She had hired Carly as her own therapist. Carly had started a private practice, Finch explained, separate from the treatment center. Not only had Finch stolen details of Byer's life, stolen the trust of her friends, she had now taken her therapist, the person Byer had trusted most in the world. In fact, Finch was about to set off for a 4-week stint with Carly in Arizona. There was an extra dark twist. Although Byer physically had her kids, she still legally shared custody with DCF. In order to regain full custody, she relied on Carly's reports to show the court that she was stable and fit. Now Finch, out in Arizona, was in her ear. Who knows what she was telling her? While that nightmare played out in her imagination, another played out on the television screen. Byer called up an episode of Grey's Anatomy, written by Finch after she left treatment, one she watched in horror. In flashback scenes, Jo works with her beloved therapist, a new character named Carly, at a mental health facility. "I had a husband who beat me, but he's dead now," Jo tells Carly. "Jo is a runner," Carly declares in one scene, referring to someone who bolts under stress. They do EMDR, eye movement desensitization, and reprocessing therapy together. Byer had used EMDR tappers, handheld paddles that vibrate and buzz, not the device in the episode. Aside from that detail, so much seemed to be Byer's story. Finch gave an interview to Self, in which Finch claimed she, too, used EMDR therapy after Pittsburgh. Another person might have hollered the injustice from the rooftops. Feeling utterly defeated, Byer got a sitter for her kids, checked herself into the Cyrus Hotel, and planned to take her own life. But she couldn't go through with it. Instead, she got in the car and drove, 3 days straight, to the same Arizona facility where she'd met Finch. She called Finch on the way to tell her that she, Finch, had won, that she should go back and take care of the kids. That's what everyone wants anyway. And the kids loved her. She asked only that she not post pictures, making herself to be the hero, rescuing the children from her sick wife. When Finch returned to Topeka, Byer's daughter, still coping with the suicide of her father, now feared the worst about her mother. Would she ever get better? According to Byer's daughter, Finch subtly nursed these fears and led her to believe that she, Jo Mama, was the only one she could count on. Byer re-entered treatment in March 2021 with a single goal, to be wherever the kids were going to be. She felt she had to make it work with Finch, who could legally retain visitation rights or petition for guardianship. Her therapist advised that if she was to remain in this marriage, she needed to explicitly say what she could and couldn't tolerate. With this plan in mind, she went with Finch to a week-long marriage intensive therapy, a last-ditch effort to save the relationship. Byer told Finch that she could not tolerate living a lie and made a list of everyone Finch had to tell the truth to. Finch's parents and her core people from childhood and L.A. friends. Finch wasn't happy about it, but she promised to do it. Finch dragged out confessing for months and months. When Yom Kippur rolled around, Beyer suggested this would be an appropriate time. Finch pushed back, saying Beyer shouldn't be calling the shots, that she had to do it on her timeline. Eventually, Finch ran out of excuses. Beyer held her feet to the fire to confess to a small group of friends, one by one, a confessional tour. In each conversation, she owned up to her lies. There was no cancer, no friend killed in Pittsburgh, no life-saving abortion. But she held on to the bit about Eric's alleged abuse as the original sin. None took it in the way she apparently hoped. According to a source, Finch demonstrated what seemed like practiced remorse, but when asked more questions in detail, shut down. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Daylight Saving Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both parts A and B are available as a podcast. Opening and closing music by Calexico.